It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It seems like nearly every day there's a new development, another ripple effect resulting from the August 14th release of a grand jury report into the sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy in six dioceses in Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about that with David Zubik, the bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh. Bishop Zubik, welcome to the Confluence.
Kevin, good to be with you and with all your listeners today. Thanks.
Thank you. Bishop, your name, as you know, was mentioned more than 100 times in the grand jury report, mostly from when you were director of Office of Clergy. Your boss at the time was then Bishop Donald Worrell, now Cardinal Worrell, head of the Archdiocese of Washington. People want to know, do you accept any responsibility for what the grand jury alleges happened?
Kevin, I think one of the things that's important from what we know, that the grand jury had 500,000 pages that they had to examine because they were looking at the Diocese of Pittsburgh and five other dioceses. And there are some inaccuracies in the way the report was is described. And so the court allowed us to be able to do a response that could, in fact, expand some of the information that was in the grand jury report. And that is attached. It had to the court order that it had to be released the same time that the report was released. And I'm just hoping that people can, in fact, read the response because it helps explain some of the things that were in there. You know, as when I was in the clergy office, I was staff to then Bishop Worrell. And I know how deep was his passion about addressing the issue of clergy sexual abuse. That was one of the things that he first had to face when he became bishop of the diocese in 1988. And so going back in terms of taking a look at my role as part of the staff, I know that if there were mistakes that were made, I mean that simply by that mistakes could have been made, or you look at things differently now than you did then, the intention was always to address the issue of sexual abuse because of the sake of the people who were the victims.
You were given the opportunity to address the grand jury. One of your colleagues, the Bishop of Erie, did testify before the grand jury. Why did you decide not to testify?
Kevin, thanks for the opportunity to clarify that. All six bishops received a letter from the grand jury, and I believe it was through the Attorney General's office, around the end of February, beginning of March. And it said, because we all expected we were all going to come before the grand jury in person. And we got a letter and it said that it's important for you to be able to have some information to give to the grand jury. And then we were offered three options. Number one, you could come and appear before the grand jury in person. Number two, you could take the fifth and not respond at all. Or number three, you could do a written response. And all six of us, including the Bishop of Erie, as I understand it, we all chose to do option number three, which is to write to the grand jury to give a sense of questions that were posed to us and being able to address those with the grand jury. And then my understanding was that I think that the Bishop of Erie was invited to come there personally. So I think it's important for people to know that I did. We all responded to the grand jury, and we did it according to the options that were presented to us.
Would it, in retrospect, though, wouldn't have looked like or appeared to be that more cooperation if you made an in-person appearance rather than, you know, a crafted statement in response, but rather appearing in person? Would that have not appeared as more cooperative?
Well, I think, Kevin, you need to understand this wasn't just a crafted statement. This was like the size of a term paper. And I think that we chose that option, and I think all the other bishops chose it because it gave us the opportunity to really be complete, to make sure that the grand jury was able to see the wide scope, and especially for us in Pittsburgh, of all the things that we've been doing over the course of the years, to reach out to victims and to establish good policies and procedures to try to eradicate sexual abuse of minors.
You were not the bishop of Pittsburgh at the time the events described in the report. But did you try to stop the reassignment of priests to other parishes?
One of the things that's important to recognize, Kevin, is that I think and the bishops were the ones who made decisions then, as I have to make them now. As you take a look at the progression of how everybody was addressing sexual abuse, and especially how the church was addressing it. If you go back 40, 50, 60 years, you see that people were so horrified by it, they didn't know how to respond to it. And that was on all levels, not just the church, but, you know, with psychiatrists, with lawyers, with police officers, with psychiatrists. But once we started to hit the 1980s, things began to come into place about how can we best respond to the needs of victims. And as you can see, that one of the major factors that comes into play in the 1990s was the role of treatment centers. If a priest was sent to a treatment center, they would diagnose, and then they would say, well, based on our evaluation that took place over the course of 6 months, we would say that this person is safe to go in ministry, and a bishop would follow that. I think it's important also to recognize that it was in the 1980s, and especially when Bishop World became the bishop of the diocese, that was one of the first issues he had to face was a scandal between three priests and two brothers. And one of the first things he did was to call all the priests together and say, if you know that there's anything going on, you need to come forward. And then in addition to that, the bishop had established an independent review board that would evaluate these cases and make recommendations to the bishop. Bishop Rowe also established the position of a diocesan assistance coordinator, who still is there to respond to the needs of the victims and help them. It was also during that time that we encouraged victims, if they were adults, to go and report the allegation to civil authorities. It was also the practice that if a person came as a minor, that we reported it. So I think that the steps that were in place at that particular time were ones that the bishop best thought could address the issue. And then as we got on, came along the way, then the bishop no longer relied solely on the evaluations of treatment centers. So, but it's a long answer to say that I think that I always supported the bishop in making decisions that were going to in fact address the issue in the best way that it could be handled at that time. Clearly, the Church of Pittsburgh today is not the same church as reported 30 or 40 years ago.
All right, I want to get to that. There's a couple of follow-ups. The treatment centers. I mean, there are people who believe once an abuser, always an abuser. It's not safe, period. Keep them away from kids, period. Why was there any belief that this person was, and I'll use air quotes, cured or ready to be allowed near children again?
Well, and I think that was the reason why I think bishops in those days relied on the specialists in those areas. And I think what has happened over the course of the years is that we've learned that, you know, in so many cases, this isn't something that can in fact be healed, but it can in fact be contained. I think in those days, people thought, well, they could make a recommendation that say that the person can go back into ministry, and bishops relied on the professionals who offered those kinds of recommendations.
Your name was on some letters that were photocopied, included in the report, to different dioceses, basically saying, it's not the exact words, that this priest who had been accused and undergone maybe some treatment was, my term, in good standing. Do you regret signing those letters? Your name is on those letters.
I think I'd have to be honest to say that the information that was there is information that indicated that he could have been in good standing. And I think in one particular case that you're making reference to, when information came forward later on about that person, the Bishop Worrell himself wrote to the bishop of another diocese and said, when I wrote to you back in 1991, I didn't have this information. I now do have it, and I want to indicate. I would not have indicated that he could or should have been in ministry. What happened as a result in that particular case is the person was called in. He went for an evaluation, and the evaluation came back and said, well, we do not see him as a pedophile or an ephebophile, and we wouldn't see any restrictions having to be placed on him. And based on that information, you know, I was directed to be able to write a notation, but it was based on the information that we had. When we came to 2002, that person then was pulled from ministry because we were beginning to understand the issue in a different light.
All right. Now, some people are wondering why the church isn't doing more to fight for justice for survivors, like working with the Attorney General Josh Shapiro to change the law and statute of limitations with the grand jury report recommended.
If they were that concerned about children and that upset about those children being raped within their walls, they would be banging down the door of Josh Shapiro and asking, how do we get this in effect?
You know, not the, at the time, I don't think I would realize, but, you know, I was being groped. I was being touched in places where you, you know, normally wouldn't allow that.
Their stories are finally getting to be told in a sense of the grand jury believed them. Somebody believed them. And we're hoping that more people out there, now that it's out, will believe them.
You know, I didn't know if I was hoping to get out of the homily, an apology, something. But I walked out the doors, and it was really emotional. I think I teared up thinking, you know, this is going to be the last Mass that I attend.
I hope that those church officials who covered it up are held accountable. Any bishops who covered up sex abuse needs to step down. They need to resign.
Bishop, your response.
Well, listening to those comments, you know, first and foremost, and I can't say this enough, I really am sorry for the ways in which the church has hurt people who are victims, and we have to be able to respond to them. We have a long history of trying to respond to victims and still do, and looking for better ways. We've done a lot in terms of helping people to heal, especially from counseling. And I know that as we're looking forward, on the day that the report was released in my news conference, I indicated some ways in which we want to build on that. We want experts to take a look at our policies and procedures, see what do we need to do more. We want to hire a person who is going to be visiting with priests who've been pulled from ministry on a regular basis. And, you know, also we release the names of the people who have been accused. I think those are ways in which we want to try to build on how we help victims. I know that when the Attorney General made his announcements, he challenged the bishops to do four things. You know, number one, that you know, that we would support the elimination of the statute of limitations for criminal offenses. Number two, that the Attorney General said it was important that there would be confidentiality agreements, and that was something we haven't done since 2002, and we didn't honor the ones before that. Number three, that if somebody knew something and didn't report it, there would be consequences to that. And then the fourth one has to do with civil statute of limitations. And right now, I think it's too early for me to respond to that because I haven't seen exactly where that's going to go. But what I can tell you is that, you know, we continue to reach out to people who are victims to look for healing, and especially since the report was released, we've had a number of people who've called to look for some assistance, and we're giving that to them.
I have several more questions. We have just about 3 minutes left. A statute of limitations. Do you support efforts, legislative efforts, or even there's been a suit filed in Common Pleas Court to change the statute of limitations retroactively? Do you support that?
Well, there are two things, Kevin, I think that we have to see. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I think it has been discussed maybe 3 years or so. The members of the Senate have said that's unconstitutional. So I think the issue of where that goes, I think, has to be worked at with the legislators. And as I said before, I think it's too premature to respond to the precision of the question. But what I do want to say is this. If there's going to be any kind of legislative move around the issue of statute of limitations, either criminal or civil, it has to apply all across the board. Because if we're going to be serious about victims, then that means that victims have to be considered seriously in every area of society.
All right. Very quickly, what do you say to the faithful who are hurt, they're angry, who aren't losing their faith in God, but maybe they're losing their faith in, quote, the men of God?
Well, the most important thing is please don't turn your back on God. And I can say over the course of the last 2 weeks, we experienced an increase of people coming to church. And I think they were coming there because they needed the strength of the Eucharist.
Okay. At the time of your news conference, you said you indicate you would not resign. There are thousands of signatories to petitions urging change in leadership. Do you understand people's anger and call for your resignation, resignation of other bishops, and what action will you take? 1 minute.
Okay, I think that I know. I can feel their anger because I feel angry as well, too. I'm enraged what some of the, you know, my brother priests did. The same collar that I'm wearing, they wore, and they used used the priesthood to harm other people. In answer to the question, Kevin, I just want to be honest to say I hope that people will take an honest look at my record. Since becoming bishop in 2007, I have done everything to try to respond to victims and to prevent any abuse in the future. And I want to continue to be a part of the healing process of all that. And I hope that people will go to the report, take a look at our response, take a look at what's on our listing of clergy who have been accused, and see on there not only the names of the person and when they were ordained and when the accusation came in, but that it was turned over to civil authorities.
All right. Less than 30 seconds. What action must you take? People say they're tired of words. They want action.
And I hope that they're able to see what we've done in the past and that we really are continuing that in the future, and especially the ways in which we've tried to respond. One of my reasons for coming here today to be with you is to convince people we really are very intent on helping victims and want to always be that way.
David Zubik is the bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh. Bishop Zubik, thank you so much for joining us.
After Roe v. Wade, anti-abortion groups began protesting outside clinics all over the U.S.
In the city of Pittsburgh, we had one of the largest movements across the country. You know, it broke loose. It just became a phenomenon.
How Pittsburgh became a national model for protests. Next week on 90.5 WESA.
In 1970, both the Manchester and Point Bridges were removed from the modern home of Point State Park to make room for an iconic hallmark of summer. The Point State Park Fountain was built in 1974 at the confluence of the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers. Today, the fountain shoots water up to 150 feet in the air, presenting visitors with a dramatic first impression of Pittsburgh. It also serves as the western terminus for the Great Allegheny Passage. The fountain turns 44 this week. I'm Mick Stinelli for the Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A double-A baseball player, a herd manager on her family's farm, head lifeguard at a public swimming pool. Their stories, their working lives are part of WESA's brand new podcast, Still Working. We're going to hear that first installment and learn a little about its inception from its co-creators. I'm joined in studio by Margaret J. Krause, who's known better to our audience, most often at least, as WESA's transportation and development reporter. Welcome, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin.
And joining us by phone in the very early morning from California, reporter, historian Kevin C. Brown. Kevin, thanks for waking up for us.
It's good to be with you, Kevin.
Margaret and Kevin, tell us a little bit about the project and how it came about.
Sure. So in 2015, both Kevin and I separately became sort of obsessed with work, what it meant for different people based on different circumstances. And Kevin had read Studs Terkel's Working, which was what people do all day and how they feel about what they do. He said, why don't we just talk to people about what they do all day like Studs did? And I was like, yes, for our time and in Pennsylvania, let's do it.
Okay, Kevin?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the reasons I think Margaret and I were interested in exploring this kind of topic in Western PA is not just that we don't always talk about work, but that by talking to people about what they do and how they feel about it, we could learn a little bit about the kinds of connections, the kinds of dissonance between different people's experience, and kind of in doing that, walking a mile in someone else's shoes, we can learn a little bit about our region.
Okay, so let's let your subjects introduce themselves.
I've broken a couple bones. I got hit by a pitch. I broke my arm. I got hit by a pitch. I broke my thumb. I broke my hand just taking a swing. And last year I had a crazy one. I had a collision and I ruptured my spleen. My name is Jonathan Schwind. I'm 26 years old and I am a minor league baseball player.
My first alarm goes off at 4:30. I'm not going to lie, I probably don't get out of bed till 5. Then you come out and you put the cows in, milk the cows. My name is Paige Friedline, and I am everything at Wanatail Farms, I guess, but I think my dad calls me the herd manager.
Sometimes I go to a grocery store and I just want to scream no running to kids, probably say it over 100 times a day. My name's Alexis Turner. I am the head guard here at Phillips Bowl in the city of Pittsburgh, and I work outside every single day.
Margaret, you mentioned Studs Terkel. Briefly, what set you off about his massive behemoth tome working?
That he let people talk for themselves. As a reporter, I'm very often trying to compress people's ideas into short sentences to fit our news clock. I wanted to let people talk for themselves.
Well, let's hear people talking for themselves.
Her fans, it's time to play ball.
We play 142 games in about 5 months. And we only have about 1 or 2 days off a month. So it's a very strenuous schedule. And if you let it, it'll beat you up and it'll make you negative, because baseball is the biggest self-esteem destroyer there is, because you're failing a lot. I've been playing baseball professionally since 2011. I've been playing baseball in general since I was about 5 years old. If you asked me in college, did I think I was gonna get drafted? Not really. I didn't really have an inclination of that, but it happened. It was a blessing, and I'm still playing and I'm still working hard to hopefully get to the big leagues. Anybody at this level has a chance. You know, when you get to Double A, Triple A, you're just a call away from the major leagues, and it happens all the time. Guys get called up. There's people, you know, that have heard how long you're going to play, and because, you know, ultimately you're not in the major leagues yet, and that's reality. I understand that. It's just like any other job. You know, if something's not working out, people are going to sway you to something different because people don't like to experience, you know, difficulty and failure and some adversity. But that's part of every job, and that's part of life. So you surround yourself with people that are positive and supportive of your goal, and I think it keeps your mind set to what you need to actually do.
So my nickname at my job is Dos. I have two X's in my name, and I'm actually Hispanic, so the name Dos, or the word Dos in Spanish, is two. My head guard gave that to me originally my first year, and it's stuck for 8 years now, all throughout the city. Whenever people say that you're a lifeguard and, no, you just get a tan, I get a little defensive sometimes. I start throwing out my work list of what I do on the daily. I have people's lives in my hands all day long. We have a pretty big staff here. We have about 8 guards. They guard the pool. They help teach lessons, clean, keep up the facility. As the head guard, it is my job to kind of work with them and get them to be motivated throughout the day.
Yeah. No. Good one. Stay here. What happened?
There's like little pieces of it, and there's that, and they said it looks like it. I had them look at their goggles.
Yeah,
I'm like, yeah, let's get. Because there's like little pieces.
I think there's
like little pieces all over the place. And there's another piece over there.
What a great day. All right, guys. Okay, guys, time to get out. We had a fecal incident.
Actually, I worked away from here for 5 years, and then I came back. My grandfather had some sort of surgery, and it wasn't a knee surgery. I was still here for that. So there was some sort of surgery. I'm gonna say maybe that was when he had his stomach ulcer. I don't know. Anyway, my grandpa was out for a while, and they needed more help, so I came back. And now I'm here, still here. There are days that this is a hard job. And there are days that this is not the worst job in the world. And there are days that I'd rather be anywhere but here. You have days when you lose a cow, or a cow goes down, or a calf dies. And those are the days you don't really want to be here, or a tractor breaks when you really need that tractor. And then there are days where there's a lot of physical labor in the hot sun, which is, you know, not a terrible day, but it's a long day and a hard day. And then there are days where it's not so bad. Now I have to go down here and chase cows around. I am currently tying them all in their stalls so they can't leave while we're trying to milk. We milk from that end of the barn to this end of the barn. Average cow makes about 8 gallons of milk a day. And then there's better ones and some that are not as good. We get $14 a hundredweight and 100 pounds of pints a pound. So we get paid roughly a dollar something a gallon. And you guys are paying for four. So somewhere somebody's making a lot of money. That middleman is making a lot of money. And it's not me. Hold on. That's my vet. Hold on 1 second. Hello? Hi, Bill. How are you? I'm good. Yeah. And then I have one, and I wasn't sure how I wanted to do it. I think I'm going to IVF her, so I'm thinking I'm going to get her bred first, and then we'll IVF her. So I wasn't sure what your schedule was with that. The cow that I'm concerned about is, she was supposed to be bred, 7 months pregnant. She lost a calf, so I don't just want to sell this cow because she didn't have a calf. So I'm trying my next step to get offspring out of her and hopefully get her back on track to be in the milking herd again. But look at her. She's so happy with her life. She doesn't have to do a thing. No baby, no milk, just exist. That was my foot.
I was actually the first woman in my family to graduate from college. So my mom was absolutely a extremely hardworking woman. She was the head of the household. She did everything. She raised 2 kids of her own. I was kind of trained to have that hard work ethic. I would say getting a career would be something I would worry about. Nowadays you have to pretty much go to college and get a degree to get a really decent paying job, a high paying job. But I looked at lifeguarding initially as just a few years of a part-time job, and now I'm going on 8 years, and it helps me to get to that goal of a career. It's definitely changed how I've looked at people. I know a lot of times growing up, kids see other kids, and it's hard to understand differences that people have. I feel that I have grown as a person working with all these different types of people.
I look at them, and I don't really see a cow. I see personality, an individual. But I think any farmer will tell you that we actually care about our cows. They're our livelihood, our lives, our income. I mean, they're more to us than just cows. In 10 years, I would probably say that yes, I will still be here. I'd like to say no, but probably. Unless the whole ship sinks. It's hard to think about doing something different because this is what my family has always done, and I was born and raised this way. And it's not that I probably would miss it. Like, right now I say I wouldn't miss it, but I probably would miss it. But I can't imagine not caring about something else. Like, I don't know what it would be like to have a 9-to-5 and go home and not care about something. I'd like to travel. I feel like when you're here, this is very, this job, industry is very tying down. Like, you can't just up and leave for a week. It's not like just watch my dog or, you know, feed my cat or have the neighbor come and check the plants. It's like you have 56 girls here that are depending on you to wait on them hand and foot, and you can't just up and leave. So
now the next starting lineup for your Altoona Curve, leading off shortstop number 19, Kevin Newman.
We bus everywhere in the lower levels of the minor leagues. And there's some long trips. You know, we go to Portland, Maine, which is, I think, over 10 hours maybe. And that 10 hours could be after a game that you had at home at 6 o'clock at night. So the road can definitely be grueling at times, and trips can be long. But you know what? At the same time, it's also allowed me to, you know, embrace life. You know, you're seeing different towns, you're seeing different cities. My off season is definitely a time to rest and time to spend with my family. spend time with my wife and try to make up for all the time that I'm not there and I'm not able to see her. My wife's a nurse. I wake up when she goes to work. We have breakfast together. It's kind of a, you know, something that she's done so much stuff for me and she's provided for me for a long time. So that's my focus in the off season is just to kind of make sure I'm showing my wife how much I appreciate her. So. The one sound that I always, and I love it, and I hear it a lot, and it's not really a, it's not really on the field as much, it's more like in the dugout or walking down the tunnels. I love the sound of spikes on pavement. I don't know why. There's something about it. It's hard to compare to anything else, really. You know, it's kind of like when you're a kid and they ask you to write down, what do you want to do when you get older?
Batting seventh, right fielder, number 24, Jonathan Schwinn. Batting eighth.
All right, Kevin, very quickly, one word answer. Which of those three jobs would you want to do for at least one day, maybe a week, or none?
Oh, minor league baseball player.
Okay, Margaret.
I'm torn, but I think I'm going to go dairy farmer.
Dairy farmer. You want to get up early, huh?
I like the world's all yours, unless you're dealing with 56 cows.
Okay. We have a couple minutes left. What can we expect in episodes to come? People who work while I'm asleep? You're asleep? Somebody else is asleep?
I think, well, most people are sleeping. But yes, our next episode is people who work at night. Kevin, do you want to talk about 3 and 4?
Yeah, and after that, we're going to be talking to people who work with bars of various different kinds. And then after that, people who care for a living in different ways.
So how did you pick these people, these jobs?
Jobs, each of the episodes is themed around a particular,
Work at night.
Work at night, work outside, et cetera. But, you know, we're making lots of choices. Some of it is inside the city, outside the city, friends of friends of friends of friends, cold calling a lot of people, and just trying to see where different jobs converge but also diverge.
And Kevin?
Yeah, you know, in this style of reporting, of documentary making, we're making choices all the time. And so we've tried a lot of different strategies to represent the very different places that Western Pennsylvania is for lots of different people.
Did you find very quickly, Margaret, the voices that they just sort of were naturally, they love talking about their work?
I think most every human in the world can talk about their own lives and would like to be asked about it. So, yeah, the people we've talked to have been really thoughtful and very indulgent of us to say, okay, so then what do you do? Then what do you do?
Okay. Look for this episode and future installments of Still Working here on The Confluence. For more information, see photos. You can find the program online at wesa.fm/stillworking. And just like The Confluence, subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts. WESA reporter Margaret J. Krause and reporter historian Kevin C. Brown are co-producers of the Still Working podcast. Thanks so much to both of us, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, should parents in Pennsylvania be legally accountable for not securing their guns that their kids use in shootings? Plus, we'll meet the new dean of Pitt's Law School, Amy Wildermuth, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news and enjoy that job.